Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Kaneko Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by anthropologist, ethnobotanist, and author of several books, Wade Davis, National Geographic Explorer in Residence, and the first speaker featured when Kaneko was first opened in 2008. He'll talk about his latest project, The Sacred Headwaters, in which he'll show how we are all connected and responsible for each other. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, May 16, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Kaneko, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Jim Linder, Interim Director and Chairman of the Kaneko Board.
On behalf of the board, our staff, and the many supporters who have made Kaneko possible, I'm happy to welcome you to this fifth anniversary celebration. And it's really, in some ways, the completion of a circle, and in other ways, the beginning of another circle. Because 5 years ago this month, our speaker this evening, Wade Davis, opened the program activities at Kaneko. And in those 5 years, over 150 programs have been presented at Kaneko that have touched more than 50,000 individuals. This programming is very diverse in its content. When we communicate the activities of Kaneko, we really put it into four general categories. First is design that encompasses architecture, fashion, art, and other areas. Second is unique performing arts. Third is innovation and entrepreneurship, with programs such as Big Omaha that was held here last week, where 650 Mountain Dew-fueled raging entrepreneurs were interacting for 2 days, listening to their apostles about how they can build their companies and transform our community and the world. And then the fourth category is ideas on the human condition. And this really allows us to explore a variety of topics that are very thoughtful, and including the work of Wade Davis as he talks about aspects of cultural anthropology in the world. The opportunity to have Wade speak with us tonight is a great gift. Wade is born in Canada, British Columbia, although he holds citizenships not only in Canada but in the United States and in Ireland. He is a National Geographic Explorer in Residence. His academic activities certainly qualify him as a world-class scientist. He has degrees from Harvard and has written 17 books and over 20 different films that bear his creative content. And those all explore various aspects of the human condition, including how cultures change in our world. He's an award-winning author, and his book in the last year, Into the Silence, was a winner of the Samuel Jackson Prize Award. And he also has touched many people in the lectures he's given. Last night he spoke about the changing conditions in Canada and how the resources there are being threatened by development, and I think he'll provide an equally compelling discussion tonight about how cultures are threatened as the world changes. So it's a great honor to have Wade with us tonight. He'll help us think more about the world we live in. Wade, please join me at the podium.
Thanks very much, Jim, and thanks to June and Ree for making this all happen, to all of you for supporting this wonderful institution. You know, culture was really born of the imagination, and the human imagination as we know it arose in the distant past when our species, Homo sapiens, evolved from its direct ancestor, Homo erectus, and somehow, infused by the spark of consciousness, embarked on a journey that would carry it to every corner of the habitable world. We, of course, emerged first from Africa. The evidence is that we diverted from Homo erectus roughly 150,000 years ago. Certainly by 65,000 years ago, we were fully Homo sapiens. And for much of our history, we shared the stage with our distant cousins, Neanderthals, also descendants of the same progenitor. And Neanderthals clearly had the spark of awareness. They used tools, they had ritual burial as long as 70,000 years ago. But whether it was the increase in the size of the brain or the development of language or some other evolutionary catalyst, our species very quickly left Neanderthal in the dust. And beginning roughly 65,000 years ago from the Rift Valley in Africa, to set off on this remarkable diaspora, a year of 40,000 years in the making that would carry our species to every corner of the habitable world in a mere 2,500 generations. And sparking this journey was a burst of intellect that left Neanderthals very much in our wake. And indeed, by the time the last vestiges of Neanderthal life had slipped away from Europe some 27,000 years ago, our own ancestors had for already several thousand years begun to express the human imagination with the stunning art of the Upper Paleolithic, reaching deep into the belly of the earth, moving through narrow passages that opened into chambers illuminated only by the flicker of tallow lamps. Men and women drew with stark realism the animals they revered, singly or in herds, using the very contour of the stone to animate the form so dramatically that the entire caverns, if you visited them, today come alive, even today, with creatures long since lost to extinction. And the sophistication of the art at all of the Upper Paleolithic caves, from Chauvet, 32,000 years before the Christian era, to Lascaux, roughly 17,000 years before the Christian era, is astonishing not only for its transcendent beauty, but for the fact that it tells us something very deeply profound about the fluorescence of the human potential once brought into being by culture. Shortly after last speaking here in Omaha City at Kaneko, I joined a very close friend of mine, Clayton Eshelman, who wrote a beautiful book called The Juniper Fuse, and for almost 40 years, Clayton, by day, had descended into the belly of the earth to try to embrace and understand the meaning of this extraordinary art. And clearly, the technical skills alone, the exploitation of ochre and manganese, iron oxide and charcoal to yield a full palette of colors, the use of complex scaffolding, the diverse techniques to apply pigments, were themselves remarkable and suggestive of a high level of social organization and specialization, as indeed was the toolkit of the Upper Paleolithic, the elegant scrapers and tools pounded from flint. The use of negative space and shadow, the sense of composition and perspective, the superimposition of animal forms generation after generation, not only reflects this amazing artistic aesthetic, but it also expresses something of a far more profound yearning. The cave art does much more than invoke the magic of the hunt. It, in fact, pays homage to that moment in time when human beings, through consciousness, separated themselves from the animal realm, emerging as a very unique entity that we are today, whether we like it or not. And viewed in this light, you can almost see the art as postcards of nostalgia, as an attempt of a conscious species to reach back across a chasm that was irrevocable and unbridgeable to a distant time of our animal nature. Proto-shamanism, the first great spiritual impulse, grew explicitly as an attempt to bridge that chasm, that separation that was irrevocable. But the most amazing thing about this legacy of art from the Upper Paleolithic is that the essential ascetic expression existed for 25,000 years, five times the chronological distance that separates us today from the Great Pyramids of Giza. Indeed, if these were, as Clayton suggested, postcards of nostalgia, ours was a very long farewell. And it also marked the beginning of our discontent, the restless yearning for meaning and understanding that has ever since then propelled the human spirit. Our entire existential experience as a species over the last 50,000 years can really be distilled into two words, how and why. How, the query of science, why, the pursuit of religion. And these two points of inquiry became the slivers of insight around which cultures were crystallized. I mean, the fascinating thing about anthropology is that we all share the same adaptive imperatives. After all, every culture must give birth to its children, educate those children, find ways for adults to come together to couple that are consistent and solid. Every culture has to deal with death and the inexorable mystery that death implies. But given that commonality of need, it's just simply extraordinary the range of blossoms that have bloomed in the garden of the human experience. You know, hunters and gatherers have settled the forests of the Amazon and the boreal forests of the far north. The Neolithic Revolution, but 12,000 years ago, when the cult of the seed displaced the hunt and the poetry of the shaman was displaced by the prose of the priesthood, when sedentary life gave rise to the surplus through agriculture or through pastoral nomadism, we have literally settled every single corner of the world. But the fascinating thing is that even as we've settled every corner of the world, and even as we've celebrated through time our differences, these differences have coalesced into one of the most parochial tyrannies in the history of our species, and that is cultural myopia, the conceit that your world is a real world, and the other peoples of the world are somehow failed attempts at being you, or failed attempts at being us, or failed attempts, in our case, at being modern. Well, the remarkable thing is that if genetics have allowed us, through the Y chromosome and the male descent line of humanity, and mitochondrial DNA and the female descent line of humanity, to trace the literal journey of men and women through the entire geography of the world with a level of specificity that would have been unimaginable 20 years ago, genetics has also done something far more profound. Indeed, the journey into the fiber of our being that is modern genetics is a space shot of this generation. If the journey of Apollo into space, that fateful day when the astronauts went around on Christmas Eve, 1968, the dark side of the moon, to see for the first time in human history not a moonrise or a sunrise, but an earthrise. Well, in that moment of crystal awareness, as the astronauts looked out at this blue planet floating, as they all famously remarked, in a velvet void of space, the whole paradigm shifted. Well, the journey of genetic science into the heart of our being has shifted this paradigm even more profoundly. Nothing, indeed, that has happened within my lifetime has done more to liberate ourselves from this parochial tyranny. Because in the last generation, biologists and geneticists have proven it to be true, something that philosophers have always hoped to be true, and that is that we're all brothers and sisters. And I don't mean that in the spirit of hippie ethnography. I mean, quite literally, we are cut from the same genetic cloth. Studies of the human genetic genome leave no doubt that the genetic endowment of humanity is a continuum. Race is an utter fiction. We are all, in fact, cut from the descendants of that same handful of people who walked out of Africa 65,000 years ago. But this is a critical thing. If you accept the scientific truth, and it is indeed a scientific truth, that we are all cut from the same genetic cloth, you have to accept its corollary, and that is that all human beings, all populations, all cultures share the same raw intellectual capacity, the same human genius, the same raw mental acuity. And whether that genius is expressed through stunning acts of technological innovation and wizardry, which has been the great achievement of the West, or by contrast, invested into the complex task of unraveling the threads of memory inherent in a myth, is simply a matter of choice and cultural orientation. There is no hierarchy in the affairs of culture. The old Victorian idea that we somehow went from the savage to the barbarian to the civilized of the strand, that there was this ladder of success that invariably placed Victorian Europe at the apex of a pyramid that swept down the sides to the so-called primitives of the world, has been utterly exposed by modern science as a idea of the 19th century as irrelevant to our lives today is a notion that clergymen had in that distant century, that the earth was only 6,000 years old. In this kind of amazing affirmation of human genius, science has affirmed in an astonishing way the essential connectedness of humanity. And ironically, given that anthropology and biology were for a generation at odds with each other, nurture versus nature, this revelation of hard science has more than anything else affirmed the central tenet of anthropology, the central revelation of anthropology, and that is the idea that the world into which you are born does not exist in some absolute sense, but is just one model of reality, the consequence of one particular set of adaptive choices that your lineage made, however successfully, many generations ago. But the other peoples of the world aren't failed attempts at being you. They're not failed attempts at being us. They're not failed attempts at being modern. Each is, in fact, a unique answer to a fundamental question. What does it mean to be human and alive? And when the myriad of peoples of the world answer that question, they do so in 7,000 distinct languages. And those languages and those answers collectively become our human repertoire for dealing with the challenges that will confront us as a species in the coming generations, even as we continue this never-ending journey. But this wonderful revelation, this revelation of hope, puts into stark profile one of the most haunting statistics of our era. There is a complete consensus in academic linguistics that of those 7,000 languages spoken the day that you were born, fully half aren't being taught to children. They're on the road to extinction. Now, those who might suggest that the world would be a better place if we all spoke one language, that somehow communication would be facilitated, somehow it would be easier for us to get along, should consider the possibility of what it would imply for you if that universal language was not English, but rather a Nuptituk, or Haida, or Tibetan. And suddenly you would begin to feel what it would be like to be enveloped in silence, to have no means or ability to pass on the wisdom of your ancestry, or to anticipate the promise of your descendants. And that dreadful plight isn't indeed the fate of somebody somewhere on earth every fortnight, because on average, every 2 weeks, some elder passes away and carries with them into the grave the last syllables of an ancient tongue. And when you accept the fact that a language isn't simply vocabulary or grammar, but a language is a flash of the human spirit, it's a vehicle through which the soul of every particular culture comes in the material world. Every language is an old-growth forest of the mind, a watershed of thought, an ecosystem of social and spiritual possibilities. You realize that to lose half the languages in a single generation is literally to lose half of humanity's social, philosophical, spiritual legacy. And this simply does not have to happen. And you will also realize, if you think about it carefully, that to lose a culture is to lose something of ourselves, because every culture, by definition, has something to say. Every culture deserves a place at the council of human wisdom and knowledge. But the challenge is, what do we do about it? You know, if you are concerned, for example, with the loss of biological diversity, and you can identify an area of high species endemism, you can create a protected area, a national park. But you can't create a protected area of the mind. You can't freeze people in time like some kind of zoological specimen. Change is one constant in history. All populations, all cultures are always dancing with new possibilities for life. So the question is, what can you do to address this sort of haunting backdrop to our age? And this is a question that was given to me 12 years ago when I was recruited to the National Geographic as their social anthropologist, with the explicit mission, as I was told, to, within a decade, change the way the world viewed and valued culture. And that was, of course, an audacious assignment. And at the time, we knew that politicians would never lead us to a promised land. They follow, they rarely lead. And we knew that polemics were never persuasive. But we had a great faith at the National Geographic that storytellers can change the world. Because, in fact, narrative, poetry, song has always been that which has moved humanity. And so I set out 12 years ago on a set of journeys to points in the world where the cultural beliefs were so inherently dazzling that you could not help but come away with a new appreciation of this central lesson of anthropology. I made with my good friend Mathieu Ricard a film on Tibetan Buddhism that we called The Science of the Mind. Now, that may strike you as unusual. Why the use of the word science for a religion? Well, of course, what is science but the empirical pursuit of the truth? What is Tibetan Buddhism but 2,500 years of direct empirical observation as to the nature of mind? Mathieu said to me, tongue-in-cheek, that Western science is too often a major response to minor needs. We spend all of our lifetimes trying to live to be 100 without losing our teeth, whereas the Tibetans spend their lifetime trying to understand the nature of existence. He said that billboards in America celebrate naked teenagers in underwear. Our billboards in Tibet are nani walls, prayers for the well-being of all sentient creatures. So we set out to do a series of journeys, and what I'd like to do tonight is take you to some of these places, a few of which I may have mentioned when I was here 5 years ago, but many of which were new to my experience in the years after my first visit to Kaneko. And let's begin with the greatest culture sphere ever brought into being by the human imagination, and that, of course, is Polynesia. Tens of thousands of islands flung like jewels upon the southern sea. And I was very fortunate to be invited to sail on this reconstructed catamaran, what the Hawaiians call the Hokulea, named after the sacred star of Hawaii. And for them, this is a vessel upon which float all of their dreams of cultural rebirth. And even today, the sailors of the Polynesian Voyaging Society can name 300 stars in the night sky. Their sailors can sense the presence of distant atolls of islands beyond the visible horizon simply by watching the reverberation of waves across the hull of their vessel, knowing full well that every island group in the Pacific has its own unique refractive pattern that can be read with the same perspicacity with which a forensic scientist would read a fingerprint. These are sailors who, in the darkness of the hull of the vessel, can distinguish as many as 5 different sea swells moving through the sacred canoe, distinguishing those caused by local weather disturbances from the deep currents that pulsate across the Pacific, moving at 180 degrees to the direction of the winds. And these can be followed with the same ease with which a terrestrial explorer would follow a river to the sea. But the most amazing thing about this tradition, a tradition that settled the entire Pacific, was that it was all based on dead reckoning. Now, dead reckoning means that you only know where you are by remembering precisely how you got there. Well, it was the impossibility of using dead reckoning on a long oceanic voyage that kept European commercial transports, for the most part, hugging the shores of continents until the British solved the problem of longitude with the invention of the chronometer. But we know for an absolute fact that 10 centuries before Christ, the ancestors of the Polynesians set sail from ancient civilization we call Lapita, after a beach in New Caledonia. And they set sail from into the rising sun. And within 1,000 years, they had reached Samoa and Tonga. And then the movement stopped for about a millennium. And then it began once again, moving across the Central Pacific, through the Society Islands, through the Marquesas, eventually moving back northwest to Hawaii, southeast to Easter Island or Rapa Nui, and then around the time of the First Crusade, reaching landfall in the island that we call New Zealand. And the most amazing thing about this is that it was all based on traditional forms of navigation and dead reckoning. And what that implied in a tradition that did not have the written word is that the navigator had to sit monk-like on the stern of the vessel, remembering every shift of wind, every shift of current, every sign of the sea and the heavens over the course of a multi-week journey. An extraordinary achievement. And we know that they were able to do this simply because of the architecture of the vessel and because of their understanding, particularly, of the celestial bodies. They recognized, for example, that every star broke the horizon at the precise moment on a certain day, and it would arc through the sky. And the place where that star broke the horizon changed 4 minutes every night. And so you couldn't follow a star throughout the entire trajectory of its movement through space because it would be distorted. But you could follow it up to a certain point, and by the time it was getting distorted, you could follow the next one. So all you had to know was 12 stars that you would then frame within the stay of your mast, and you could actually stay on course throughout the night. But this implied knowing hundreds of stars in the night sky and remembering where each one broke the horizon every night, and that shifted, of course, 4 minutes every night. So it represented mental acrobatics that were quite extraordinary. And the metaphor, the beautiful metaphor, was that the ship itself never moved. The navigator, through consciousness, pulled, as they said, the islands out of the sea. And my good friend Nainoa Thompson decided, as a young man, to pull Rapa Nui out of the sea from his homeland of Hawaii. Leaving Oahu, they sailed 6,000 miles, crossing the doldrums, tacking into the wind for 2,500 miles, all to reach an island less than 25 kilometers across, less than a degree on a compass, had a compass been on board. But there were no compasses on the Hokulea on that voyage. There were no sextants. There certainly was no GPS. There was only the visionary world of the Polynesian wayfinder, that and the hopes of the dreams of a people being reborn. If you took all of the genius that allowed us to put a man on the moon and applied it to an understanding of the sea, indeed what you would get is Polynesia. But if we leave Polynesia and move into the greatest forest, we enter the homeland of the people of the Anaconda, the Barasana, the Makuna, the Tanimukos. These are the people who know the Amazon better than any other people. The Amazon, this vast forest, larger than the continental United States, larger than the face of a full moon. The Barasana people believe that mythologically they came up the Milk River from the east in the belly of the sacred serpent, only to be regurgitated in the various affluents of the northwest Amazon. A people who live so closely with that forest that cognitively they do not distinguish the color blue from the color green, for the canopy of the heavens is equated to the canopy of the rainforest. When I was a young student, the Amazon was described to me in ways that simply reinforced and provoked cliches, even as it defied hyperbole. It was the greatest forest on earth. Joseph Conrad said the Amazon was less a forest than a primeval mob and a remnant of an ancient era when vegetation rioted and consumed the world. And that was very much the image we had of the Amazon when I was a young graduate student in the 1970s. This was the Amazon of green hell that our professors had spoken about in their youth. But of course, by the time we came along, the cliche had shifted and the Amazon was no longer a green hell. It had become an Eden. The term jungle itself had gone out of fashion, and we were told that the rainforests of the world were these counterfeit paradises, these castles of immense biological sophistication built on a foundation of sand. And this idea of the delicacy of the tropical rainforest, which all of you have heard about, came about really because of a publication in 1952 by a forest ecologist by the name of Richards, who was trying to draw a distinction between the temperate forests of the northern climes and these tropical forests. And he recognized quite properly that in a temperate zone, with the periodicity of the winter and the deposition of leaf litter on the forest floor and the rich accumulation of organic material in the soil, that the biological wealth of that ecosystem was the soil itself. Whereas in a tropical system with a high rate of humidity and decomposition, leaf litter literally decomposed as it fell from the forest trees, and so the living vegetation was the biological wealth of the system. And the destruction of that forest would set in motion, it was said, a chain reaction of biological consequences of dire significance. Well, that fundamental distinction between those two types of forests was a legitimate thing to think about, but when applied to a forest seven times the size of the province of Ontario, it was as much slogan as it was science. We now know, after 50 years of field research, that half the Amazon, or a good maybe a third of it, is savanna. We know that there are areas in the Amazon, collectively the size of France, of rich black soils of human origin. But the idea of the Amazon as a slogan, as a fragile place, persisted because on the one hand it fed the needs of an environmental agenda of those concerned about the deforestation of the Amazon, particularly on the Brazilian frontier, but it also fed our clichés about what it meant to live in the Amazon. Now, by the time anthropologists arrived in the basin in any numbers, the original populations had been wiped out by European diseases for 500 years. Anthropologists were attracted to the surviving real Indians, and these tended to be small societies living along the flanks of the Eastern Cordillera, from Venezuela south to Bolivia, areas protected by geography and cataracts from the east and protected from the west by the Andean Cordillera, which was not traversed by roads until the 1940s and after World War II. Now, these societies, like the Guarani, who I told you about last time I was with you, a remarkable society, a society first peacefully contacted in 1958, five missionaries in 1957, attempted contact, made a critical mistake, dropped from the air black and white photographs of themselves and what we would say friendly gestures, and the Indians picked these things up from the forest floor and had never seen anything two-dimensional in their lives. So they looked behind the face to try to find the form to the figure, saw nothing, and concluded these were calling cards from the devil and speared the missionaries to death. The Guarani also speared each other. 54% of the mortality was them spearing each other. And they lived in open fear and open warfare with their neighbors. They called all their neighbors kuwade, cannibal. And so these societies, living alone, in isolation, often in open conflict with their neighbors, became our image of what the Amazon was all about. Now, these societies had great gifts. The Guarani could smell animal urine at 50 paces and tell you what form of life left it behind. These societies had explored the botanical realm with great care. Great natural philosophers had discovered pharmacological principles, such as the poison known as a flying death, curare, which yielded D-tubocurarine in the 1940s, a muscle relaxant which would radically shift and revolutionize modern surgery. And they also practiced the shamanic art of healing, a shamanic art of healing that was based on their ability to invoke some technique of ecstasy to soar away on the wings of trance, to get into these distant metaphysical realms where they could work their deeds of medical rescue. And I explained when I was here before that this really accounted for one of the curious anomalies in botanical science, that of the 120 known hallucinogenic plants, fully 90% are from the Americas, not because the other forests of the world are uninteresting, but because other peoples in other parts of the world had other avenues to the divine. But in the Americas, the use of these curious psychoactive plants was really the key to their art of healing, the key to their visionary realm. And what's interesting about these plants is not simply their dazzling pharmacological effects. This is a plant known as ebene, the semen of the sun, discovered by my professor Schultes in the 1950s, full of these powerful tryptamines that induce a sort of kind of an elimination of reality. To have this stuff blown up your nose is like being shot out of a rifle barrel lined with Baroque paintings and landing in a sea of electricity. It creates not the distortion of reality, it creates a disillusion of reality. I used to argue with Professor Schultes that you couldn't classify this as hallucinogenic because by the time you're under the influence, there was no one home anymore to experience the hallucination. But we're interested in these plants because they tell us about a different way of knowing. Now, those tryptamines are taken through the nose for a specific reason. They cannot be taken through the mouth because tryptamines are denatured by an enzyme found naturally in the human stomach called monoamine oxidase. They can only be taken orally if taken in conjunction with some other drug that momentarily denatures the MAO in the human gut. Well, the fascinating thing is that the main ritual preparation of the Northwest Amazon, ayahuasca, the vision vine, is precisely such a combination. The leaves of a nondescript shrub full of tryptamines and the woolly bark of a liana with these beta-carbolines, which are MAO inhibitors of the precise sort necessary to potentiate the tryptamines. But the interesting question, of course, is not simply the dazzling effects of these plants, but the fundamental question, how in a flora of 80,000 species of vascular plants did the Indians learn to combine these two morphologically distinct denizens of the rainforest to create this powerful synergistic effect? And the only scientific explanation is trial and error, which quickly is exposed as a meaningless euphemism, statistically irrelevant. The Indians, of course, say that the plants teach us. But those points of wonder in these small societies cause people to think that that was sort of the norm in the Amazon. But in the last 20 years, our whole attitude of the Amazon has changed. And curiously enough, this change came about in part through archaeology, but in part because people simply opened their eyes to the obvious. When Aureliana in 1541 went down the Amazon, the Dominican friar Carvajal, who documented that horrific journey, did not describe an Amazon that was empty. On the contrary, it was dense with population. Cities were described. And we now believe that the Amazon was in fact the home of millions of indigenous people who, of course, were swept away within decades by the arrival of European disease. And the question that has now haunted us is there a place in the Amazon where the shadow of those civilizations still falls, where the voices still echo? And the amazing thing is that there is, and it lies in the homeland of the people of the Anaconda. These are societies that are not in conflict with their neighbors. On the contrary, they have complex rules that facilitate trade and peace, not war, not the least of which is that you must marry someone who speaks a different language. And so in any one language, you have six and seven languages spoken, but you never hear an individual practicing a distinct tongue. The children simply wait, watch, listen, and one day begin to speak. The longhouses in which they live are the size of this room. Every feature of the architecture resonates with mythological significance. They were structures that in every way rival anything the Maya and the Inca built. They were simply made of plant material and did not survive. And the most incredible thing is we now know that the mythology of the people of the Anaconda, in its incredibly Baroque complexity, amounts to nothing more or less than a land management plan that with great precision dictates precisely how human beings can in fact live in the upland forests of the Amazon in great concentrations, in great numbers. And the amazing thing about all of this knowledge is that it came this far from being snuffed out. When I lived with these people in the 1970s, it felt like a place where something had happened a long time ago. But now, there was, in fact, an anthropologist, Stephen Hugh Jones, who went on to be head of anthropology at Cambridge, who in the late 1970s participated in a series of films for the BBC called Disappearing Worlds, in which he predicted the end of the Barasana people, sadly. And we made a film after I left Kaneko in the northwest Amazon with this people, and halfway through it, Stephen flew in from London, and he looked into this longhouse and saw 300 men in full ritual regalia, all the families dancing, all of them ingesting ayahuasca, the men, for 3 days and three nights, not becoming a symbol of the ancestors, but literally becoming the ancestors and moving through metaphysical space back to the points of origin of the great culture heroes. He couldn't believe his eyes. He got on the satellite phone to his wife back in London, and he said, "Christine, you won't believe what I'm seeing. Nothing disappeared. The only thing that disappeared were the bloody missionaries." And indeed, this is a great example of how these cultures are not destined to fade away. What in fact happened in the northwest Amazon is that a Colombian president called Virgilio Barco said to my good friend Martin von Hildebrand, "Do something for the Indians." And in 5 years as head of Indian Affairs, Martin did more than something. He secured legal land tenure, collectively an area the size of the United Kingdom, for the 57 ethnicities of the northwest Amazon. And behind a veil of isolation created by the chaos of the drug war, a totally new dream of culture was reborn. And you know, when we asked some of the elders why they had allowed the missionaries to do what they had done. And a great friend of mine in Canada, Chief Justice Sinclair, as a Native American, said to me, there's only three questions in life. Who am I, where do I come from, and where am I going? And the key thing that happened at the time of European contact is that the European dominant society said to all the First Nations of Canada and the Americas that the answers you have had for those three questions for all of your history have been wrong. That was really the psychological blow. And when we asked these elders why they allowed the missionaries to do what they had done, one of the elders said something very profound. He said, because they promised us that they could make us humans. And of course, that was a crushing cultural blow. But this is an example of how cultures, in fact, can be reborn. Now, in my travels, I became very interested in notions of sacred geography. And I don't mean that in the spirit of hippie ethnography once again. I mean, what does it really mean to believe that the earth is alive, responsive to the human desire, even as human beings have clear obligations to the earth? What does it mean, for example, for my godson in the village of Chinchero outside of Cusco in the southern Andes of Peru to believe that the mountain that dominates his community is a deity, an apu that will direct his destiny? How does that make that child different than a kid from Omaha raised to believe that a mountain is simply a pile of rock ready to be mined? I was raised in the forests of British Columbia to believe those forests existed to be cut. That made me very different than my friends amongst the First Nation who believed that those forests were the abode of demons and spirits that had to be embraced during the initiation rites such that the individual could bring back the spirit of the wild to the community in the potlatch. The interesting question isn't who's right and who's wrong, but how the belief system in a metaphorical sense defines a relationship of a culture to landscape with profoundly different consequences. Well, I went down, of course, to South America initially to study coca, the sacred plant, the divine leaf of immortality, and to do the first nutritional studies of this remarkable plant that, yes, has a small amount of cocaine hydrochloride in it, benignly absorbed through the mucous membranes of the mouth as a benign and gentle stimulant in a harsh environment. But we discovered as well that the plant was chock full of vitamins, full of nutrients, more calcium than any other plant used by any human population, enzymes which enhance the body's ability to digest carbohydrate at high elevation. And we showed in this one simple set of studies that this was a plant that had been used with no evidence of toxicity, let alone addiction, for over 4,000 years in South America. But with coca as my lens, the ancient rhythms of the Andes came into focus. And I became interested in these notions of sacred geography. So, for example, in this community of Chinchero, once each year, the fastest young boy is given the honor of becoming a woman, a wailaka, a transvestite. And wearing the clothing of his sister or his mother, he leads all able-bodied men on a run. But it's not your ordinary run. You start off at 11,500 feet, run 2,000 feet down to the base of the sacred mountain, and then you run to 16,000 feet, only to fall away onto the backside toward the sacred valley, and then traverse two more Saurian Andean ridges over the course of a long day. The metaphor, of course, is that in completing the run around the boundaries of the community land, the individuals who go into the mountain as individuals, through sacrifice — sacrifice in Latin means to make sacred — through the effort, they reemerge as a single pulse, a single community that has reaffirmed their sense of place on the landscape. And at the age of 48, I became the only outsider ever to run the Movimiento and the oldest man ever to do it, and I only succeeded to get through the day by chewing more coca leaves in one day than anyone in the history of the plant. But what really got me through is that I had baptized children in that beautiful village for 30 years, and when they heard that their godfather was stupid enough to run the Movimiento at the age of 48, they all came racing out to the village, and they clung to me like limpets throughout the entire day. They weren't about to let anything happen to their cash cow. But these localized rituals become pan-Andean in these events like the Coyariti, a kind of Andean Woodstock, where the people gather by the thousands in a sacred valley that expresses a perfect fusion of 500 years of Catholic faith and pre-Columbian notions of landscape and spirit. And so the iconography is often that of the church. The people bring the crosses from their communities up to the ice fields, but in the shadow of the most sacred mountain of the Andes, and they plant their crosses in the ice, and then 24 hours later, they bring them down, having empowered them with the spirit of Pachamama. Well, these contemporary rituals even shed light on ancient archaeological mysteries. I'm sure many of you have been to Machu Picchu and were told that it was a lost city. Well, that was a little bit of marketing on the part of the National Geographic. Machu Picchu was never a lost city. You can see the linkages of the roads all around it that connected it to the network of 14,000 miles of roads that the Inca built in less than a century. But more importantly, Machu Picchu is linked to notions of cosmology and sacred geography. The axis mundi of the site is this abstract stone that Bingham called the hitching post of the sun. It's the Intihuatana. It actually reflects constantly the light that falls on the sacred mountain of Machu Picchu, which is a sugar loaf, Huayna Picchu, behind it. But if you come this side of the Intihuatana, you find an altar. Climb to the top of Huayna Picchu, you find another altar. Take a direct north-south bearing, and that bearing will dissect Salcantay, the second of the most important sacred mountains of the Inca, just in the clouds scoring the skyline. When the Southern Cross, a very important constellation, is in the southern extent in the sky, it is in that same alignment, enmeshed in the stars of the Milky Way. But what is the Milky Way but the heavenly equivalent of the Urubamba, the serpentine river that snakes around the base of Machu Picchu? But where is this river born? In the very snowfields of the Coyariti. And so 500 years after Columbus, these ancient ideas of sacred geography are still expressed and celebrated in ritual. Now, if the pre-Columbian voice is fused with Catholic faith in to make the sort of dynamic world that is Pan-Andean South America, there is one place in South America where the pre-Columbian voice can still be heard unfettered, and that is in this astonishing volcanic massif, the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta, that soars to 20,000 feet right out of the Caribbean coastal plain of Colombia. It's inhabited by the descendants of the ancient Tairona civilization, the Kogi, the Arawakos, the Kankuano, and the Wiwa, who fled the conquest into this massif and were to this day, in a blood-stained continent, they've never been fully conquered by the Spanish, and they remain ruled by a ritual priesthood. And shortly after I left Kaneko, I was able to embark on one of the most extraordinary expeditions of my career. The metaphor for these people is the loom. They say, upon this loom I weave my life. As they move up and down the mountain, exploiting various ecological niches, they refer to their movements as threads, such that over the course of a lifetime, each man and woman weaves a cloak over the body of the goddess, Sedanqua. The temples where the men celebrate have five, they're conical structures. They have four layers of the upper world. This is our world, and four mirror image layers of the underworld. They have a hole at the very top of them, and there are four sacred hearths with a fifth one in the middle. At both the spring and fall, the summer and winter solstices, the temples are aligned so that the sun rises in the east and sends a beam of light onto this hearth, and then by the end of the day it sends a beam of light on this hearth. And then at the winter, it's the other side, going like that, and then at the fall and spring equinoxes, when the sun rises to the meridian, the beam goes down, the priest sends up a shield to reflect it into the heavens, and then you see the men begin to move toward the western door of the temple. What they're doing is removing the heddle from the divine loom of the Creator, because over the course of a solar year, the divine sun weaves a cloak over the body of humanity. It's just an amazingly Baroque culture. Now, they are ruled by a ritual priesthood, and in the 1940s, a very famous Colombian anthropologist by the name of Reichel Domatoff reported that the training for the priesthood was astonishing. He said the young acolytes were taken away from their families at the age of two or three and then sequestered in a shadowy world of darkness, 2 9-year periods deliberately chosen to mimic the 9 months of gestation in their natural mother's womb, now they were metaphorically in the womb of the Great Mother. And for this entire time, the world only existed as an abstraction, as they were taught the values of their society, which included the idea that their prayers and rituals literally maintained the cosmic balance. And at the end of this incredible initiation, the youths at the age of 18, having never seen the sky, were taken on a sacred journey to the heart of the world. And the priest who had trained them steps back and says, as they see this beautiful landscape, it's as beautiful as I've always told you. It's yours to protect. Now, that was a story that was almost an ecological or anthropological fable. It was almost too good to be true. No anthropologist had ever accompanied one of these journeys. No one had ever documented one of these journeys. And then an amazing thing happened. This man walked into my office at the National Geographic with the Colombian ambassador. His name was Danilo Villafaña, and he was with three priests who were barefoot in the winter days in Washington, one from each of the three dominant tribes. And as I was talking to him in Spanish, I couldn't help but say, you know, Danilo, I don't mean to be rude, but you look like an old friend of mine. And I showed him this photograph, and it turned out that the man on the left was his father, and his father had, Adalberto, had been murdered by the paramilitaries. And I said to Danilo, you may not remember this, but when you were a baby, I carried you on my back for months up and down the mountains with your father. And this man on the left was his cousin, and this man now is this revered elder, Eugenio, second from the left. And based on this incredible coincidence, Danilo said something incredible. He said, I'd like you to go with me on a journey to the heart of the world. And so we did, and with a film crew. And what we discovered is that at least today, the young acolytes don't spend 18 years in the darkness, but they do spend 18 years in the environs of the sacred circle, never leaving those confines. Much of the time, indeed, in the darkness, in the night, as they acquire this sacred knowledge. And then it is true that they're taken on a journey to the heart of the world, as we made this film about them. And every ripple in the landscape resonates with spiritual and mythological significance. Even the hats the men wear are a conscious attempt to mimic the snowfields found at the heart of Sarancua. And then we ran into the unexpected. One stage away from our ultimate goal, we found the priests, when we got there at dusk, in a circle doing this. And that meant that when they pray, their thoughts are as threads, and so they a gesture of weaving as they pray. And we knew something was up, and what was up is that we had just missed getting kidnapped by the FARC by about half an hour. A FARC patrol had been following us. They knew we were from the National Geographic, and they had just left this hamlet as we rounded the corner on our mules. Now, I can't promise you that we had a dramatic escape. You don't really have a dramatic escape on a mule. You kind of clip-clop your way to rescue, but they took us immediately, that darkness came, and then we went up through the spectral light of a full moon on these tracks through these cliffs that only the Indians knew, and in the morning we ran into a firefight between the 5th Battalion of the Colombian Army and the Marxist guerrilla bandits, and we had just walked into a hornet's nest, but mercifully we simply handed our cameras to the Wiwa fellows that we had trained, and they finished this section of the film for us. And amazingly, you cannot tell where their footage begins and the Bollywood directors and cinematographers end. We then went back to the coast, where even today, though the sacred sites are covered by skyscrapers, the elder brothers, as they call themselves, continue to pray for our collective well-being. It's humbling to think that not 2 hours from Miami Beach, these individuals, in a very defiant way, and speaking in full paragraphs, are begging us to change the way that we treat the world and to reform our ways. Now, I always work by the adage of Marshall McLuhan, if it works, it's obsolete. And after 4 years in South America, I was anxious for a change. And my wonderful professor, Schultes, that I mentioned earlier, summoned me to his office in the spring of 1982, asking me casually if I wanted to go down to Haiti and infiltrate the secret societies to secure the formula of a drug used to make zombies. Well, naturally, I said yes, having no idea that the assignment would consume 4 years of my life. And within arriving in the African reality, something was made available to me that had eluded me in 4 years in the Amazon and the Andes, And that was truly a window wide open to the mystic. You know, it's interesting to ask yourself to name the great religions of the world. What continent is left out? Sub-Saharan Africa, the tacit assumption being that African people had no religious beliefs. Well, that's ethnographically nonsensical. Of course, they had religious beliefs, and voodoo is not a black magic cult. The word is simply a fon word from Dahomey that means spirit or God. And in the religion of Africa, the people have a direct relationship with the divine, such that they literally bring the gods into their bodies. And once you're taken by the spirit, a spirit cannot be harmed. And so you see these theatrical gestures, individuals slicing into the skin before a fetish symbol in Benin in West Africa, or more powerfully in Haiti, voodoo acolytes in a state of trance, handling burning embers with impunity, a rather astonishing example of the body's ability to affect itself when catalyzed in a state of extreme excitation. And really, this four-year project became a way of making sense out of sensation and showing that the religion of voodoo was as legitimate as any other religion, and that zombies were simply one small thread woven through the fabric of an extraordinary society. But, you know, in the end, then we had to sort of, you know, ask ourselves what kind of world do we want to live in? We have this sort of idea that these cultures, quaint and colorful, are somehow destined to fade away as if by natural laws, if they're failed attempts at being modern, failed attempts at keeping up. Nothing could be further from the truth. Technology is never a threat to culture, nor is change. As I mentioned earlier, all cultures are always dancing with new possibilities for life. It's neither change nor technology that affects the integrity of culture. It's power. It's a crude face of domination. These indigenous people are not destined to fade away. They are, in fact, dynamic living peoples being driven out of existence by identifiable forces. And that's actually an optimistic observation, because it suggests that if human beings are the agents of cultural destruction, we can be the facilitators of cultural survival. I wrote a book about my voodoo experience that was made into the worst Hollywood movie in history, called The Serpent and the Rainbow. Hemingway said that if you sell a book to Hollywood, you should start off in Arizona, drive to the California state line, throw your book over, and then go back to Tucson and have a drink. I didn't do that. I slipped away into the forests of Borneo. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from the Kaneko Lecture Series on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a talk by anthropologist, ethnobotanist, and author of several books, Wade Davis, National Geographic Explorer in Residence, and the first speaker featured when Kaneko was first opened in 2008. He spoke about his latest project, The Sacred Headwaters, in which he showed how we are all connected and responsible for each other. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, May 16, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Heike Langdon, Kaneko Events and Community Relations Manager, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Special thanks also to sound engineer Rick Weiner for his assistance in the recording of this program. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.